Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 397 of the podcast as we get too close to 400. And it's Friday, 12th of October, 2018, as I record this, and it's raining and storming outside. One of my favourite, one of my favourite climates. I think that's why I live in England. So today I'm talking to Beck Evans, who is co-creator of the Prolifico app. And we're talking about what does it really mean to be prolific and how can you put things in place so that you can be more prolific and the ebbs and flows of your own individual creativity and what that means for a lifetime. And of course, I bring up Picasso because I always do when it comes to, being creative and prolific and also earning great money. Picasso is my go-to example. So yeah, here we go again. In publishing news, we're still on the audio fun. I mean, really, this is a big deal. So Frankfurt Book Fair had their first audiobook conference. So Frankfurt Book Fair obviously has been happening for a long time. It's the biggest rights fair in the world, I believe, in terms of selling rights. It might not be the biggest book fair, but it's definitely the biggest rights fair. And for the first time, they've had a separate audiobook conference as part of Frankfurt. And lots of things coming out of Frankfurt, really interesting, lots of stuff. But one particular thing that was important is Apple has told publishers to be ready as it prepares to roll out its new audiobook platform. This is big news, people. Now, I have heard rumors about this for a while, but I haven't really said anything because there has been nothing official. This is still not quite official, but Apple themselves at Frankfurt have said, be ready. And there was no launch date disclosed, but some people were saying that it's very close. So the other thing that also happened was last week or something, Kobo expanded their audiobook support to CarPlay. And those of you who've been listening for a while, I talked about CarPlay probably 18 months ago, so that you can essentially sync your audiobooks with your car. Of course, if you have one of the various voice tools, whether it's the Echo or Alexa or HomePod or Google Home or any of those voice assistants, you can also sync your audiobook. But what this Apple thing is about really is the thought, the consideration that it's got to be within the next couple of months, right? So let's say Q1, so quarter one, before April 2019, it is most likely that we will be able to go direct with audiobooks to Apple and also to Kobo. This is huge. We've been locked in to ACX and Audible only for years now, and this seems to me a really big shift. So obviously I'm excited about audio. I've talked about it a lot, but this for the distribution, for the potential of some more competition in the audio space is fantastic. Also fascinating was the discussion at Frankfurt around a smart speaker take up and voice AI stuff. So again, a lot of you after last week have asked me to do a special edition on what's going on with audio. I'm going to need to do some research and kind of organization on that. Obviously, I talk about it in the news segment, and I've talked about it a number of times, but definitely I want to do that, but I'll probably leave that till Q1. But essentially, this is going to be fascinating. Also, many people talking about streaming and subscription models for audio, pay per minute. Now, again, Audible has done this with ACX Romance, and that has had some very bad press around the rates. So, and also it's exclusive. So I'm kind of hoping that we're going to get a non-exclusive subscription potential model as Kobo are doing. doing with Kobo Plus in the Netherlands. Hopefully that will be the type of model we see going forwards. Also, remember that subscription models also sort of form part of what Patreon is for authors. And thank you to all my patrons, and I'm going to give some more people a shout out in a minute. But what's interesting with the potential of patronage is that we can do potentially some of this type of subscription stuff with voice, with ideas like Patreon. So again, as ever, I'm super excited about all of this. And that moves into my personal update, because yesterday I actually did my first voice coaching session. It was so good. I really needed that help. And I will be talking about it more as I go into that some more. But, you know, we did some warming up stuff. We used my own short story, which is what I'm aiming to have recorded by Christmas, and played around with it and read it in different ways and, you know, explored how I could use my voice more as an instrument. And I think this idea of playing, of being confident with voice, of trying to be a real person and not just a narrator, I was definitely struggling with that. You know, this sort of, what am I? Am I a performer? Am I a narrator? Am I the author? Am I the character? That type of sort of side of things is difficult when it's narrating a book, because you're kind of partly all of those things. And especially when it's your own work, it feels quite a serious thing to do. So I'm trying to bring out my playful side of JF Penn, which I think is going to be really interesting, especially with this story. So this story is called Sins of the Flesh, and it's in my Thousand Fiendish Angels collection, and it is a kind of homage to Lovecraft and also based on Dante's Inferno. And it was a commissioned short story for Kobo a few years ago now, and I've re-edited it. I will be narrating it myself. It will be about 25 minutes, I think, and it will be out before Christmas. So I'm really excited about that. It's definitely going to take more work, but I'm just excited about it. I really am. And I'm going to have some more changes to come in terms of what I do in terms of saying voice first. Also, if you, I talked about voice first last week, but if you actually use the hashtag #voicefirst on Twitter, you'll find a whole community of stuff going on around voice. It's fascinating to me. This is a very interesting time. So also on the subject of play, I'm just trying not to take myself so seriously, because I really do. I'm such a serious little sausage, as my husband calls me. But I went to a flash fiction evening with Jonathan, and it was really good. I haven't written any flash. I have written some pieces that could be flash, but essentially flash fiction, it has to be a story. It can be a few hundred words, but certainly less than 1,000 words generally. Some of them really short, but not prose poetry or poetry. Like, this is flash fiction. And so many of you may already write it. It's a very vibrant community. And what I like is that you don't have to commit too much to a piece of flash. And it was a lot more fun. People reading their flash was kind of a lot more fun than people reading their very serious chapters from books, which is, I think, how I've become so serious around things. It's like, do you know what? This is just a bit of fun. So I really enjoyed that flash fiction evening, and this freedom around writing, around creating, around performing. Just trying to be more fluid. I think that's another word, the sort of fluidity of creation, this theme of fun and not taking everything too seriously. And in fact, it brought to mind, you may have seen this week, Banksy. If you don't know Banksy, I'm in Bath. Banksy's from Bristol, which is just down the road, the biggest city near me. And Banksy obviously started out in what used to be called graffiti, and is now called street art. I think there is a difference between graffiti and street art, but certainly he started out with graffiti, and then now his street art is worth a lot of money. And one of his paintings was being auctioned in the very serious art environment and spontaneously shredded itself after it had been sold for over $1 million. And there's these brilliant pictures of all these art people watching as this painting shreds. And whether it was a stunt, or, you know, always a sort of taking the Mickey out of the art world. Who knows? But now they're saying that this painting is actually worth more money because it was because shredded, it's kind of, it's got more prominence and it's famous. So I just found that hilarious. I was like, yeah, good on you, Banksy. That's awesome. Okay, so that's some of my personal update this week. One thing I did want to ask, if you use Spotify, finally, Spotify has opened up to podcast sort of production or distribution from the wider group. So I have submitted this podcast, the Creative Pen podcast, to Spotify. So if you are a Spotify user, I'm not, I don't really listen to music very much. I listen to rain and thunderstorms. That's my life. But if you do use Spotify, can you please check that the Creative Pen podcast is available? It would be really useful for me to know that it is working. And if it's not, please tell me so I can get that sorted. As ever, you can tweet me at the Creative Pen or email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. So in the useful stuff segment this week, I have a couple of really cool things. First of all, I am doing a webinar with Joseph Michael, the Scrivener coach. Yes, we're doing Scrivener. Now, some of you may have been on this webinar with me before, but this is the latest version of Scrivener. Scrivener? Scrivener? I have now written 27 books using Scrivener, and it really is my number one writing tool that I recommend to everyone. And I still learn something from Joseph every time because his job is teaching people how to use Scrivener. So it's a fantastic webinar. What Joseph does is he actually, normally I will start off by talking a bit about how I use Scrivener, and then we go into essentially the whole webinar is a demonstration of all the various features. And what's so funny is it starts off and it's like, yeah, I knew that. Oh my goodness, I didn't know that. That's awesome. I'm going to use that. So I always learn something. So I'm excited about this. We haven't done one for ages. So come along to our webinar and learn how to use Scrivener in a much more effective way. It is aimed at people who want to do NaNoWriMo, but it's useful whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction and whether or not you're doing NaNoWriMo. So it will be Wednesday, 24th of October at 3 p.m. US Eastern, 8 p.m. UK. But as ever, if you register, you can get the replay. So check it all out at thecreativepen.com/oct24. So OCT24, thecreativepen.com/OCT24. And all the links are on the show notes as ever at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. And secondly, so that's one really super useful thing if you're writing. And if you want to create an online course, then the Teachable Summit is on, which is a number of free webinars and teaching sessions on how to plan, build and sell your online course, including what kind of topics are selling well on the Teachable platform. And I use the Teachable platform for my courses on how to write fiction and how to write nonfiction. And I love Teachable. I think they're just great. They are very focused on online education, which of course is something we all love and we all do a lot of these days. And the free sessions are on 23rd to 25th of October. So essentially, if you sign up for Scrivener and Teachable, you're going to get a ton of free training. So you can register at thecreativepen.com/summit18, SUMMIT18, thecreativepen.com/summit18 for the Teachable Summit. Very exciting if you want to create an online course and add another stream of income to your author business. All right, so thank you so much for all your emails and tweets and comments on last week's show. I'm really thrilled that so many of you found it useful, and I've been enjoying emailing back and forth with some of you, also joining in the comments on the blog posts and tweeting, and generally just feeling very happy that I spent the amount of time I did creating that massive thing last week. I mean, it really is so much work to do those solo shows, but I know that you guys find it useful. And I can't possibly mention everyone who commented or tweeted or things, but please do continue to let me know what you're doing while you're listening to the show or your thoughts on the topics we cover. So Emily Robertson says, this podcast was just what I needed this week. Thank you so much for reminding me that this whole journey is about doing what I love, both in writing and marketing. And thanks, Emily. I need reminding myself. So I'm glad you enjoyed that. Lindsay Barocca, hi Lindsay, says in a comment, the id list was great, something I'd sort of grasped, but not thoroughly analysed. And it's interesting that we'll all tell ourselves to be original and do different things, but I know the further I get from my wheelhouse of things I love, the less excited I am about the story. And of course, Lindsay has the fantastic science fiction and fantasy marketing podcast. And some of you said to me, why don't I interview more people about success on KU and have a balanced view on all of this? I think the fact is that a lot of people do interview, and I do. I mean, look, I've had lots of people who have success on KU on the podcast, but I don't focus on what are the short-term tactics in KU. And the reason I mention it here is because Lindsay has interviewed lots of people about this, even though many of her books and her co-host's books are wide. So definitely have a listen to that show. A great podcast about a lot more to do with marketing. I think this podcast now is a lot broader than just publishing stuff. I mean, I'm really trying to be more and more evergreen around things. Yeah, I don't know. I also feel that in terms of wide stuff, there's so much talk in the author community about KU that I feel like I'm almost on the side of the underdog talking about wide publishing. So there you go. Anyway, that's my chosen topic. And of course, I don't have to be impartial because I'm not. That I'm not a reporter or anything. It's just me. Okay, so back to the comments. Laura Morelli, I wanted to pick this one up. She says, fantastic link roundup. Thank you so much. Can you give us more specific how-tos on building an audience on the wide retailers? I've long been wide, but struggle to gain traction. Okay, so this is a really good point, and I'm actually going to be interviewing a few people between now and Christmas on how to find attraction on the wide retailers. So we will be covering that. I did talk a bit about that with Apple, I think, last week. In general, I will be talking about this around Kobo, but also around Apple and around Google and in general. So don't worry, that is coming. Okay, just a few things. Oh, also Natasha says, I always greatly appreciate your solo episodes. In particular, I found your thoughts about audio very prescient. My inner voice and gut keep saying audio, audio, audio. Hence my new podcast I'm launching in 2019. Fantastic. Thank you, Natasha. And, oh yes, Jim Wilborn says, just listening to your Doubling Down podcast, I totally agree about the future being audio. Also, I listen to you at 2x speed. I listen to fiction at 1.3x and nonfiction at 1.5x. I sometimes listen to articles with a text-to-speech app as well, which is fantastic. And so many really interesting people have been sending me things about audio listeners who get the super fast pod fasters, I think they're called, just some great articles, people listening at 3x. So yeah, this is so fascinating. I'll keep coming back to this. Right, so today's show is sponsored by Draft to Digital, and I'll play a word from the lovely Kevin Tomlinson in a minute. And of course, his voice will seduce you. So thanks to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons over the last few weeks. And another reason I should do more solo shows is when I do them, I get lots more supporters. So thanks to Chris Nowak or Chris Novak, Detective Adam Richardson from the Writers Detective Bureau podcast, Renee Wright, John Ackers, Chris Ann Blair from Christmas Organising, Karis Smith from the Balancing Act Mom, Victoria A. Wilder, Joe Williams, Lisa Lang Blakeney, Diane C. Perez, Leanie Brown, Rosie Arcade and Krista Adams, and also to Brian Reller for increasing his pledge. As ever, I really appreciate the Patreon support, like your tweets and emails. It demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And just as an aside here, I was going to say, this is something else I'm thinking about as I move towards the 10-year anniversary of this podcast. And of course, I will be starting another podcast next year. So I need to do something to clear some space, because obviously I'm also writing more. And I am thinking of moving this show to only doing interviews every 2 weeks, and then still keeping a weekly show and doing a little bit longer personal update and some kind of topic in the other weeks. So let me know what you think about that. I know a lot of you do listen to, I mean, I want to keep doing the interviews, but they do take quite a lot of time. And I feel like, you know, we're kind of moving into an interesting space where I'd like to keep doing the commentary side, but I will be moving some of my interviews onto this other podcast, which I will talk about more once I know what I'm doing. So love to know what you think about that. And of course, on Patreon, I charge for 2 shows a month anyway. So basically, I will be thinking about that. Let me know what you think. Tweet me at The Creative Pen. If you're a patron, send me a message on Patreon or something. And see what you think about that, whether you listen for the interviews or whether you listen for the intro or both. Okay, so if you'd like to support me on Patreon, you can throw in a couple of dollars a month, or even a little bit more if you're feeling generous, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, including the backlist and lots more audio fun. And I will be recording this month's audio Q&A in the week coming up this week. So please put your questions in if you are a patron. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right. Thank you so much to everyone supporting the show. Here's a word from our lovely sponsor, Drafter Digital, and then we'll get on with the interview.
Hi, this is Kevin Tomlinson with Drafter Digital, bringing you the D2D Smart Author Tip number 1. Did you know you can format your ebook for free with Drafter Digital's ebook conversion? You don't even have to distribute your book through D2D to use this free tool. Just create or log into your free Drafted Digital account, upload your manuscript as a Word doc or RTF file, and let D2D do all the work. Conversion takes only a few seconds, and you can download your book to use anywhere and any way you like. You can even choose from a large library of beautiful, professional ebook templates, and that will really make your book stand out. We've been working hard to create an ever-growing selection of very cool, very attractive templates that give your books the professional polish that makes readers take notice. No special operating system or computer required. Log into D2D from any browser on any operating system and get started. And of course, because it's D2D, it's free. And if you'd like to reach the widest possible audience, be sure to use Drafted Digital's free ebook distribution to major online retailers worldwide, including Apple iBooks, Kobo, Tolino, and more. Start reaching a bigger audience now. Convert your manuscript, distribute it online, and get the support you need the whole way at drafteddigital.com/pen.
Today, I'm here with Beck Evans. Hi, Beck.
Hi, Joanna.
It's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Beck is a writer, a startup founder, and an ex-bookseller with a career in publishing and running a writing retreat center. She co-founded Prolifico, a digital coach for writing that helps people who want to write, start, and finish their projects, which we're talking about today. So before we get into the details, tell us a bit more about how you got into writing and also working with writers.
Yes. Well, you could say it's like a childhood ambition from the first time I held a book in my little jammy hands. And I think the whole of my adult career has been spent working with writers. So as you said, being a bookseller, getting into publishing and doing pretty much every job in publishing. The last was working in innovation, so on the technology side of things. But I also worked directly with writers. So when I used to run a writer's retreat center, people would come on courses. And that's what I really enjoy. And that's what I do now at Prolifico, is work directly with writers and at scale.
Mm. And it's so interesting, because when I think about those writer's retreats, and I guess just a question, what did you notice about writers that made you want to kind of get into the sort of helping writers be more prolific? What was like, you were looking at them going, why do they have this problem?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I was writing myself, and I have written for, again, it feels like my whole life, but it was very much as a hobby. And what was fascinating is coming into contact with writers every single day, you start to see patterns of behavior. So whether that's around procrastination or the way people really struggle to find time for writing and find a place for it in their life. Mm. And the retreat center is amazing. I mean, it's just heavenly and a beautiful place in the world. And it's very, very inspiring place to be. And I found that some writers could literally only write when they came there. So when you work there for a few years, you'd find people would come back and go, oh, I haven't written a word since I was here last year. And you kind of think, well, you're never going to finish your novel like that. But it was very much that I had the same problem finding time in my life to write that so many of them did. And I got to learn from the really successful ones, the guests who would come in and give talks and the tutors who would teach each week. You just picked up so much advice.
Mm, just tell people which retreat centre that was, because there's so many.
There are. So it's for Arvon, and it was the Lumbank one. So Arvon, I think, was the first retreat centre. It's celebrating its 50th anniversary this year, and they have three retreat centres around the world, around the country. And this one was Ted Hughes's old house. So it's up in West Yorkshire on a beautiful steep-sided valley.
Yeah, fantastic. I've heard about Arvon. So yeah, I think people can have a look at that. But let's talk about being prolific. So I wanted to first ask, what is your definition of prolific? Because I think people do have kind of different ideas. And why is it important, do you think, for authors who particularly want to make a living?
Absolutely. So what I'll start with is the most literal definition of prolific, which is just producing a lot. And I think that's an important definition because people make a judgment that being prolific is about being low quality. Mm. And I think research has absolutely turned that on the head. And there's two kind of reasons that for that. The first is the sense of deliberate practice. If you want to get good at something, you have to practice, you have to work at it. And being prolific is a route to that means. So you carry on writing and producing a lot. And the second reason is that you are also the worst judge of your own ideas. You don't know which ones are going to work. So you have to have several. There's no point in working on a single masterpiece throughout your life because it might not work out. So the more you produce, the more feedback you get, whether that's from your audience, your readers. And then going back to you become better. So you get to understand what works. So I think, you know, we need to stop being snobby about being prolific and help people find what that means for them in their own lives.
I'm glad you said that. And I mean, we're both British, obviously, and I do find there's a little bit of snobbery in Britain, whereas I think the Americans relax a bit more.
Yes.
About being perfect. But I was thinking about this in terms of, I mean, someone like Enid Blyton would be someone who's incredibly prolific. Charles Dickens, obviously, hugely prolific. And then I was thinking about Picasso, who I always use as this example. Over 50,000 pieces of art Picasso created in his lifetime, some of which, if you go to the museums, was really pretty bad. And then, so, you know, a few of them are just world famous. And he died, when he died, he was worth 500 million, which when he died was obviously a lot more than it is now. But it's so to me, that's the kind of, you know, Picasso created a lot, some of which was amazing artwork. So is that the kind of thing you're talking about, really?
Absolutely. And I think Picasso is a really good example of that, because it was almost like he did so many sketches for each finished piece. It was like that got him to get to the final piece. So he was being sort of prolific within one piece of artwork even. But over his whole lifetime, I bet you he didn't know when he was making them what was necessarily the good stuff or the bad stuff. He had to get through all of that.
Mm. And what annoys me, I think, about the writing world is that such a big deal is made out of a debut when, you know, with Picasso, if you look at what he did in his early years compared to what he did later on, I mean, obviously you get better. So, you know, what you've been in publishing a long time and involved with books, what is that about?
It is. It's just, I mean, I don't think I could give an answer to that. I think, well, actually, I bet you it's the equivalent of when we get a new idea, we fall in love with the new. And it's very easy, particularly as writers, to suddenly forget about something we're working on and go for the easy new thing that's exciting. And I think it's just the same with authors, that they focus on their the front list, the new, and put all the energy behind that. But actually, if you're talking about writers who are trying to make a living, who are trying to make a career, they need a backlist. They need to have a body of work. And it's only through that body of work that they become, you know, the writer they're meant to be.
And I always look at, it's not all about money. It's also about craft. I mean, and I think you get better as a craft person over time. Yes. With practice. But also the authors we see in the richest author list, they generally are, yep, Stephen King, Nora Roberts, James Patterson, authors who've written a lot of books.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Fantastic. Okay. So what if authors want to be more prolific? What are some of the key practical things that they need to do, to get into that place?
Yeah. So I think the first thing they need to do is, you asked me what my definition of prolific is, and it's like an author needs to figure out what that means for them as well. So for some of them, it will be about learning their craft and becoming better writers. Mm. For others, it will be about creating a body of work. And for others, it will be about finding an audience and finding out what that audience likes. So they might like to experiment with different types of genres or styles. So I think that's the first place someone would need to start. And then if they want to be prolific, if they have to prioritize it within their life. And it really goes back to those basics, that if you want to turn that dream into reality, it needs to take place in your life. And there's different ways of approaching this. So there's a few kind of analogies around choosing not to do things. So stopping doing other things so you can find space for writing. And there's that classic, you know, the four burners, which one are you going to turn off to become successful? And the other approach is just around scheduling and fitting writing into your life. So if you know you want to create a body of work and it's important for you to work at it, you need to make time for it.
Mm. And then what about place? Because like I find when I'm creating first draft material, so that kind of real creative brain stuff, I can't be at this desk where I'm talking, yeah, to you now. This is like my email desk, my podcasting desk, my accounting desk, you know, so I have to go somewhere else. And you mentioned the retreat center, but I don't think that's practical to be prolific because this costs money unless you get some kind of fellowship, right? So how can people do the place thing? Is that important?
I think it is. So when I talk about sort of writing productivity and all the writers I've worked with, it's not about necessarily finding a habit. It's about building a system. So having support structures around you is really, really important. And place is one of those. It's often people find that they get procrastinate when they're at their work desk. They get distracted if they're at home. So, I mean, I just do it as almost a thought experiment. It's like, well, what's the equivalent of finding your kind of writer's retreat center? So for some people, it could be going to a cafe. I know myself, I rent sort of a desk, a hot desking place, and it's got Wi-Fi, it's got other people around, but it's not got any of my stuff. Mm-hmm. And it means for the time I've blocked, I can just concentrate on the task I need to do. But I get people to quite literally brainstorm ideas about how they can remove distractions, how they can find that place, and then kind of commit to going to it.
I mean, I even think with being in your house, and there's nothing wrong with it if people are choosing to do that, but I find when I'm here, I'm like, oh, I've got to put the washing on, need to unload the dishwasher, you know, and that forms into sort of that procrastination thing. But I wonder, I mean, because I know some people struggle with this, how do people justify it, I guess, or explain to their family that they have to leave the house and maybe hire a co-working space like I do when I'm dictating? Yeah. I will hire it and it costs me like $10 an hour. Or when, yeah, I go to the cafe every morning, I'm buying, you know, at least a coffee an hour. So it does cost money. So how do people justify that to their family, especially if they're not making money right now?
Absolutely. So it goes back to that finding the priority within your life. So if you make that intention and you set it as a priority, you do need to get buy-in from other people. And actually, it's going to be really hard to work on even, you know, one novel, let alone a series of novels, if you haven't got the support structures and the people around you. So it is actually really hard to kind of tell people and almost negotiate it. And, I've had to do that myself. I run a business with my husband. So when I need to find time to write, it's almost like you have to negotiate and build that in. And I think it's a barrier that stops people. So they do have to prioritize it in their own life, and then talk to people about it. And it's literally things like putting it in your calendar, seeing it, treating it like any other appointment, gives it that credibility. And I think when people pay for writing, it does help them commit. So whether it is a cup of coffee, which can cost, you know, it's not cheap, yeah. Or if you are renting a room, you know, you're not going to faff around in that time. You know, you really get down to it. So actually, I find paying small amounts is a really good way to hold people to account.
Yeah. And just on that co-working space, so I haven't joined one because I only do that when I'm dictating a first draft, and then I will edit at the cafe, and I'll, you know, sometimes write at the cafe. So I just book ad hoc, and that costs a bit more for ad hoc hours, but I know that I don't need it for, you know, more than a couple of hours every day. So I think people listening, and I agree with you, when I pay for that time, sometimes I'm like, oh, I really don't feel like writing, but I'm going to go because I booked it and I paid for it. And when I get there, I'll always end up writing a few thousand words, right?
You always do. It's like you don't wait for the muse, particularly if you're trying to fit it in. You show up each time, and it's not always going to go to plan, but that showing up is part of that process.
Mm. So are there some mindset issues that might also come into play around prolific?
Absolutely. So I kind of think of mindset in a couple of ways, because it's about the understanding your own mind, it, really practically in terms of how your brain works and your psychology, and then mindset in the sense of almost having an intention. And so you start with that intention to write, and then I would look very closely at sort of setting sort of your ambitions, making quite concrete goals, and that gives you something to aim for, and then understanding how your mind works. So if you just look at the neuroscience of your brain and your brain energy, you need to be well rested, you do need to be fed. Creative thinking, writing, those higher order functions are incredibly draining. So you need to kind of figure out when's a good time for you to do it and be prepared to do it. So it's no good just saying, I'm going to get up at 5 a.m. because you actually might be at your tiredest. It might not be the best for you. So you need to figure out what your own psychology is, what your own strengths are, and then really play to those.
Mm, I like that you mentioned that stamina thing. I really think that's important, especially like when people are starting out, they can't do 2,000 words in a session. And like people are like, oh, I'm such a failure because I've only got 300 words. But as you say, it's very taxing. And I think it's a bit like, you know, any kind of fitness. You have to kind of work up to these bigger writing sessions if that's how you're going to do it. Like the thought of going to a retreat for me is quite scary because I only, you know, when with my writing, when I'm doing first draft, I probably can only do 2.5 hours of that. Yeah. Really intense work, and then I go and do other things. So like being forced into a place for a whole week like would probably kill me. But that stamina, is that's something you've noticed as well?
Definitely. And it is, I think the analogy with exercise is really important because it's about building up that stamina. So thinking about how you're, as you become a more regular writer, it does get easy. So I know when I started cycling to work in London, I had to go up this very steep hill. I remember after a couple of months just thinking like, why isn't this getting easier? But the whole point is it is meant to be hard. I was getting much, much fitter, but I was always working at my limit. And I think that's what you do as writers. So when you first start, it can just be a few words, but if you keep turning up, it increases each time. It doesn't make it easier to do because sometimes those words are always going to be hard. And the second book is going to be as hard as the first book. But that's because you are getting better. It's about that deliberate practice, that training and working for it.
Mm, I'm glad you said that because it does feel that I've just literally today sent off Valley of Dry Bones, which is like my 29th book or something, to my formatter. And I was like, oh, what? You know, how does it not get easier? But you're right. It's because you're always pushing yourself to the edge so that you can keep improving. That's a really good point. I never thought about it that way.
Yeah, because if you're not, if it's not hard, then you might not be working hard enough. You know, you could, there's always that little bit. And I think that's really important around when you set goals. They have to be almost at the edge of what's possible. but then you have to kind of break stuff down and make it much, much smaller so you can achieve it. So again, this is where psychology really comes in, because a lot of people want to write and then they set an ambition that this is the year I will write my novel, and they kind of start doing something, and then within a week or two, you know, it's traditional New Year's resolution territory, they give up, they get overwhelmed, it's not working. But what you need to do is have that goal, but then approach it in very, very small, achievable steps. You know, reflect on how you're doing, reward yourself for what you're doing, so you're able to keep going, keep that stamina.
And then I think one of the pros and cons of the writing every day thing, first of all, I mean, when I'm doing my first draft binge writing, I'm kind of a binge writer. I do try and write every day or at least 5 days a week, because I want to get that first draft done. And then the editing becomes easier once you have something to edit. But we've had Michael Brent Collings on the show talking about depression, and in The Healthy Writer as well, Dan Holloway writes about how if you have certain mental health conditions, sometimes you can't write, or some people, you know, have something happen in life, moving or death in the family, and then they feel guilty that they can't write every day, and I just hate this idea of guilt being associated with writing. So what are your tips, I guess, for getting rid of that guilt? But it's a really difficult balance. You want to not let yourself off the hook too much, but be gentle, and then also get back on track. So what are your thoughts around those things?
Okay, well, I'm so glad you talked about daily writing, because I'm going to tackle that first, because I think there's a real dogma around this, and I think it leads to people making unhealthy comparisons. So, you know, whenever you go onto Medium or blogs and people kind of talk about the, you know, the best way to write is to get up at 5 a.m. and do it like this. And, you know, there is no one size fits all approach to writing. So you need to stop comparing yourself. It's really, really important. However, when we look at all the research around writing productivity, it shows that writing daily is the most productive. And it's quite frightening. So it was Dr. Robert Boyce back in the 1990s, where he compared binge writers with daily writers. And daily writers outperformed on every level.
Oh, no, I'm a binge writer.
No, I don't think you are. I think you're a different type of binge writer. I'll talk about his definition. So his binge writers were people who leave it to the last minute and it's done in a state of panic.
All right. No, that's not me.
That's not you at all. So you... What's the word where you kind of just throw it all down?
I think I'm a project by project writer.
Yes, but it's kind of like burst writing, isn't it? It's kind of like you've got to get it down and then you find the shape and then you've got something to work with. So he compared the scheduling side of binging, and binge writers were found to also suffer more from depression and anxiety and fear of judgment, a huge amount more than the daily writers. But I feel that his research, while it's still valid in knowing that daily writing is very, very beneficial, it's almost impossible for many people, particularly those starting out. So don't compare yourself around that. And that what I have found is that the most important thing, and the thing that keeps people feeling happy with their writing, is figuring out their own system. And I think that looks different for everybody, that there's really good research out there on productivity and forming habits and accountability and keeping going and building the resilience. But it is different for everybody. So I would say taking time to reflect on what works for you is probably the best way to approach it. And for people who have lost their place in a novel, who are not on track at all and are feeling really bad about it, go back to simple psychology and neuroscience, set very small steps, tiny, tiny things, and then do it and then feel good and reward yourself. And then it's easier to turn up the next time. And what you do over time is you crank it up. So it could just literally, some of the research coming out of Stanford, they would say something like, sit down with your notebook for 5 minutes, don't even write anything. And it's like, oh, you've done it. So the next time it would be, well, write something. Or what can you write? And it's just, you just build it up over time.
Yeah, I like that. And I this is such an important topic right now in the indie community, particularly where the pressure on rapid release publishing has become a bit of a mantra. And yet at the same time, we're seeing burnout amongst authors. And so everyone has to manage this themselves, because I do have friends who very happily can write for 8 to 10 hours a day, actually write 10,000 words a day. That's not me. You know, I write a couple of books a year, and it's hilarious because I get emails from traditionally published authors saying, oh, how do you manage to be so prolific? So I think what you're saying about, and the comparisonitis thing is inevitable, isn't it? But this, it's such a... it's such an individual thing, but you've also got to look at your goals, because as you say, if you take 5 years to write one book, you can't expect to make a living unless it really is something that publishers will pay a lot of money for.
Definitely.
It's very difficult. So I'm really interested, because you've taken a lot of this research and you've created this Prolifico tool. So tell us a bit more about, why did you do that and what does it kind of do?
Yeah, well, it came directly from my experience working in the Writers' Centre. So I was spending all that time with writers and seeing what they struggled with. And it just coincided with, I was obsessively tracking things on my iPhone. You know, when you get loads of apps and you do your exercise and your steps and it could be different health measures. And I just thought, why isn't there a Fitbit for writing? You know, there is loads of technology that helps people improve their habits and their behavior. You know, what would that look like for a creative practice? Is that even possible for a creative practice? And that's when I just really started to dig into the psychology of behavior change and what habits and writing routines look like. And then over the last few years, it was just building up what Prolifico looked like. And what it is, sort of simply, is a digital coach for writing. So it helps people set goals, break that down into small steps, and then track their progress against them. And it's very much about self-reflection. No one can do the work for you, but you need to figure out for you what actually works. And look at the times you are most productive, the times you feel happiest with your writing, and then try to build that more into your own writing system.
And I find it, on the one hand, I'm really fascinated by it. On the other hand, I feel the resistance, and I feel people listening, feeling like resisting this, because it's kind of big data and analysis. And, I just feel the two sides could be difficult for some people. So how can that kind of data about our behavior help us create for the long term?
Yeah, so I think you're absolutely right. It's not for everybody. And I think people need to, a lot of writers keep journals. And I think that's a really good self-reflective practice, which also builds in a lot of that learning. And I think people doing morning pages also does that. So there are lots of different approaches. But data is anything that's kind of countable or measurable. So it could be as much as going to a writing group and seeing what your friends in the writing group like about your writing. You know, that is data in a sense. So in the same way that having download figures on an ebook, having click-through rates on your blog, those are forms of data that help people figure out what's working, and then they have to kind of figure out the why it's working. So if you apply that to a creative practice, people often start off setting too big a goals, being too ambitious, and then what they learn is to break it down to a level where they can start to achieve it, and then they're kind of the good stuff around habits and reward kicks in and it keeps them going. So you know, they could just literally look back. Some people like to track words. Some people like to track time spent. Others just like to track how they felt about it, how it went, was it good? And other people just like to look at, do I write better in the morning or the evening? Can I do more at a certain time of the day? Other people, I kind of look at, there's lots of different processes involved in writing, and not all of it is that very creative first draft. So some people figure out that they are too tired to write in the evening, but it's really good for editing. It's really good for doing interviews. It's really good for doing their planning or their research. You know, they can do a few Google searches. They can figure out stuff for their work at a time that's not necessarily their peak writing time. And it's up to the individual to use the data that's available to them.
I think you're right. And I mean, you've seen lots of this data now, and you've had articles about this. And I wondered, like, what's one of the surprising things that has come out of this that maybe you've gone, wow, I didn't realize that would happen? Or some author who said, well, I used this thing and I discovered this.
Oh my gosh, that's such a good question. I'm so geeky about data. I'm always sort of really interested in how people do that. But the thing with Prolifico is that the data is the users. It's not, we don't kind of do, we don't do a huge amount with it because it's their data. What we do is we run a lot of surveys. And what we have found is where writers, we do surveys with people over longitudinal studies, is about how sort of levels of happiness and satisfaction change over the lifetime of an author. And particularly with, we did one study looking at academics, and that when they start, that's when they're under the most pressure and they feel most stressed and they have the least satisfaction. And they also have no systems in place to support them. And the longer people write, the easier it gets, and the more likely they are to find systems and have certainty about what works for them. So there is also something about that keeping going. So anything you can do at the beginning or at the difficult times is what's going to keep you going in the long term. And literally, the people who use Prolifico, who achieve their goals, who submit stuff, that's when they start, things start really happening for them. So it's, I think, every writer needs to figure out what's going to keep them on track and almost sort of, I was going to say, ruthlessly exploit it. But it's literally like that. If you know that you need to go to a place or treat yourself with cake or whatever it is, just use that.
I agree with you. And I recently did a video on kind of creative routine. And even though I do a lot of research all over the world, I need boredom and routine and, you know, normal habits and plain food in order to actually get my work done. And then once I'm finished, then I'll go away again and fill up the creative well. But I think you're really right. Once you nail your process and your place and your habits, then it becomes much easier, at least to feel like you have a way to do it, even if the writing won't become easier.
It will always be hard. So find your enjoyment in it. Find the pleasure in it. You know, you don't need to be masochistic about it. And that, you know, when people, the one thing I have found with writers is they don't reward themselves enough. And when they finish, they don't celebrate. They already start kind of worrying about the next thing. And actually, I would say that would be my call to arms with writers. Like, yeah, figure out your system, figure out what works for you, but find some pleasure in that, even if it is just the finishing.
Yeah, it's funny though, because like I said, today, as I said, I've handed this final manuscript to my formatter for the print version, and yet I celebrated at the end of the first draft, but then there's a hell of a lot after the end of the first draft. To me, it feels like the biggest achievement, and then at this point, it's, you know, I've just been doing the tiny little additions of little changes from a proofreader, and that to me is really annoying work, but it has to be done. So now I'm like, okay, now it's, as far as I'm concerned, I just upload all my files and it's done. So I know what you mean about not celebrating enough, but it feels like to me that there are so many different points in the writing and publishing process, particularly, that it's hard to know when to celebrate, especially as indies, we don't really do book launch. You know what I mean? So, and the more prolific you become, the less getting the book into the world, you know, that publishing thing becomes exciting.
Yes. Yeah. So I would say, so if we go back a little bit to around goal setting, so achieving your kind of goal to finish a book is a whole series of milestones. So from that kind of doing the research, having the idea, doing the first draft, editing the first draft, editing, you know, submitting it. You know, and as an indie author, it would be, you know, getting a cover done, getting it typeset, getting someone to proofread it for you. Every single one of those is a milestone, and they're all a different activity. So they require different energies and processes. And I think they require different rewards, because actually you might feel happier when you press, I'm just trying to think, is it when you send it off, when it is typeset? Is it when you've made the cover?
I like holding it in my hand. Like when the print book arrives, I'll be like, okay, this is cool. And actually I'm doing a hardback for the first time. So that's actually going to be quite a big deal. Like getting my first hardback is quite cool. So I know what you mean. And I agree with you. People really need to sort that out.
Yeah.
But just before we finish up, because we're almost out of time, but you actually have a book coming out next year, which I'm quite excited about, How to Have a Happy Hustle, which is interesting because as you've said there about celebration, you run a company with your husband, which my ears pricked up at, because I do too. And I wondered, you know, what's in that book and does it include some of your learnings about all this stuff?
Oh, absolutely. So the book, I mean, for one thing, it's my first book. And I'm so, you know, I've been writing forever, but this is my first with a publisher. It's being published by Icon in the spring next year. And I too submitted it this morning. So I was up at 5 a.m., you know, proofreading and doing that final spell check before I was, you know, nervously sending send on the email. So yes, I am going to celebrate this evening. But How to Have a Happy Hustle is all about how we can celebrate the small things in life that help us achieve the really big goals that we have. And it was very much about putting together a lot of the psychology of making ideas happen. So it was using my work in innovation about how people can work with other people to make ideas happen, how they can brainstorm, how they can test, and how they can enjoy that process and take it in really, really small steps, finding the time so they can get to the end rather than getting overwhelmed and thinking, well, I'm never going to launch a side hustle. I'm never going to have a startup or a side business or write a book or do the things that people want to.
Mm.
But acknowledging all the time that it's a hustle. It's hard work. You know, you've got to work at it. But I think you can find the happy in your hustle. I really do.
Yeah, I do too. And you're so right about these small goals, because I think there still is this myth about, oh, and of course you're writing your first book, but you've been in publishing long enough to know that that book won't come out and you won't suddenly be a multimillionaire overnight. Like, that seems to be still this myth. And then people feel so disappointed. Like, I don't think I've ever met authors as disappointed as people whose first book has just kind of arrived, when they've still got this myth of overnight success. Whereas actually what you're saying, I think, is that if you celebrate the small things along the way, then you're not hanging everything on this one big dream that may or may not happen. And of course it happens for some people. Don't get upset, listeners. Yeah. But, you know, celebrating along the way makes the process and the journey much better, right?
I think you're right. So it's enjoying the process and finding the pleasure in that process, because actually that's the only bit you can control. You can't control what people think of your book at the end. You just can't. It's not, there's so many factors at play, from, you know, the publisher, the platform, the cover, just everything. And there's nothing you can do, or very little you can do. So you have to focus on what you can control. And that is the process of how you get there. And it kind of goes a little bit back to the whole prolific thing. It's like, you know, if you enjoy the process, you're more likely to do it again. And then who knows, it might be the second one or the third one, or actually when you've done three, you've suddenly got, you know, spines out, you're on a bookshelf, you know, you've suddenly got a portfolio, you have a backlist. That's when things start to take off.
Or you have 29 and it's all just lots of little small streams of income that all add up. So I think you're right. So tell us where people can find you and Prolifico online.
Yep. So we are Prolifico. So it's Prolifico. So it's with a K rather than a C. So prolifico.com. We are on Facebook and Twitter. We have a blog. And you can find us, all over the place on the internet.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Beck. That was great.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
So I hope you enjoyed the discussion with Beck today. And of course, keep Picasso in mind as you create in the week ahead and be prolific. And of course, remember, if you'd like to sign up for the webinars, either the Scrivener webinar or the Teachable stuff, come along over to the show notes and sign up for those, thecreativepen.com/podcasts. And this is episode 397. Can you believe it? So next week, I'll be talking to urban fantasy and paranormal legend Sherilyn Kenyon about 80 million books sold and tips for writing and long-term author success. So I'm pretty pleased about this one. This is going to be fun. So that is coming up next week. I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.